thanks everyone for coming to our first online event. This event's about how to find your first e-commerce idea in 1 hour without information overload. So I'm your host, Terry. You probably heard me on the podcast, and also I'm here with Andrew Yudurian. What's up, Andrew?
Hey, not much. Thanks for having me on, Terry. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so Andrew was from episode 14, in case you guys missed it. And so what we're going to do is we're going to just go over how to find an idea and some very general tips into just getting started. And we're actually skipping a lot of information today, and I'll go over that in some more detail in a bit. So welcome again. Thanks for coming on here. Our first event, so you know, don't expect too much. This is all our first time here. And just a quick format about the show. We're going to do a 30-minute presentation. Kind of I'll go over some slides, and I'll hand it over to Andrew. And then we'll have a 15-minute Q&A after where you can type questions in the chat. And this is also recorded, so if you disconnect or have to miss it, I'll put it on the website after I edit it later in the year. So you can always find us, Andrew, ecommercefuel.com, Twitter at Yudurian, and me, buildmyonlinestore.com, at it's me, Terry Lynn. So let's just get into it. Okay, before we get actually a little bit about Andrew. So Andrew runs a dropshipping business called Right China Radios, and he has, I believe, two businesses. Correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, and they're total about over $1 million in revenues. And he was on episode 14 of the podcast, as I mentioned, and his blog is ecommercefuel.com, and Right China Radios is kind of these radios you see that truck drivers use, I guess, in movies that they use to communicate with each other. So what's up for today? So here is our agenda for today. We're going to go over through what is value, you know, because a lot of people say value are benefits. And so we break that down into more detail on the value equation that I found through a book. And we go through the purchasing cycle of how people buy things online, and what's the process they go through from awareness to purchase. And also, how does content marketing fit in? And you always hear on the internet, you know, you got to make a blog, you got to make content, content marketing. So how does this all fit in to content marketing, to the purchasing cycle when you're trying to sell people products on your online store? So things that people pay for, we're also going to go over this real quick, and three ways to find an idea, random tips, and then Q&A. So some things we are skipping. These are kind of more in-depth topics within finding an e-commerce idea. So this is all very important, but for the sake of the time, we can't really go over through all of this for today. So there's a guide for this later on that I'll tell you guys in the end. And so let's just get into it. So what is value? This is the equation I found from a book by Alan Weiss called Million Dollar Consulting. And so basically, how do you discern the value from a hamburger from, say, a car, right? So you have different benefits that go into this equation: tangible, annualized, intangible, and emotional and peripheral. So emotional and annualized are the big amplifiers in this equation, if you notice that. And it's because these, if you look at why people buy, buying is a very emotional decision, right? So when you're thinking of your products, always kind of keep this in mind, and don't just focus on the features and benefits. Always remember the value that you're adding, and also the emotional impact your product has on their person. So for example, golf, people are very passionate about golf. It kind of has emotional impact towards them there. Whereas a club, for someone that doesn't like golf, is just a piece of metal and they whack a little ball around. So this is the equation that you should keep in mind. Very useful. And example of benefits, just to get into
Terry, do you mind if I jump in real quickly there?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I heard one thing that was said that stuck out to me was people buy based on emotion. The emotion is kind of what kind of sets the hook for people and sets their interest and gets them really interested, and then they'll use logic to justify it. So logic is great once you kind of have them hooked or at least interested, but you need some kind of an emotional, or it's very helpful to have some kind of an emotional attachment to get them into kind of that sales funnel, and then you can close the deal with a logical persuasive argument.
Yeah, and emotional stuff can come from, I guess, the story of your business, kind of if you have a video of yourself about the store, you can do it through pictures, you can do through audio, and really just getting past that online barrier into really showing the emotion. So yeah,
definitely.
All right, and so example of benefits, you know, tangible stuff is stuff that you can actually see, right? Like you can save money, you have good health, you can get around, and annualize, you just times it by a year, right? Pretty simple. Intangible stuff, you know, do you buy this to be cool, to show out to your friends? You know, is there some benefit you give off of your image? And emotional, we went over that just a bit. Peripheral is maybe, you know, you buy an iPhone and you bring it into your car and realize, hey, you don't need the radio anymore. You can actually put your own MP3s or, you know, my podcast in your car. So these are kind of like peripheral benefits. So, and let's go on to the buying cycle. So, for example, when you buy something online, these are kind of the topics that people, that goes through in your mind when you're looking for a product online, right? You go from awareness, maybe I want something, consideration, do I really need it? What are my options? Interest is when you really start narrowing down kind of the different options you have. And then when you go into preferences, you're looking at features, you probably made your decision already, and then you can finally go to purchase. And so how do people buy stuff? Well, take Andrew's business, for example, right? So someone says, hey, maybe I need a radio for my little Optimus Prime truck here that I have. You know, I'm a cool transformer. I'm a huge robot. I want to buy a radio to talk to my other robot crew here that's driving around with me. And so, you know, what do I need to look for when I buy a radio? What size do I need? What frequency do I need? You know, what kind of cables do I need? How do I install it? You know, and then you start Googling, hey, what's the best radio for this type of car? You know, is the power going to be working and stuff like that? And then finally, you go on eBay, you go to Amazon, you start looking at the best sellers. I mean, you know, you start looking for the social proof of what people are buying. And then finally, you maybe look for a review on YouTube. What does it actually look like in a car? And what are some people actually, what the feedback is, actually when people use it? And also, when you finally purchase, you know, by this time you're done, you put your PayPal password in and you've bought from Andrew, hopefully. So where do you add value in this cycle then? Because everyone says you have to add helpful content, you need to do content marketing, you make a blog. So basically, if you look at the purchasing cycle, consideration, interest, preference. When people are looking on YouTube, they're looking for reviews. If you have that all on your site, that's awesome, because then they don't click elsewhere when they're looking for this content. And because if they click elsewhere, they probably won't come back when they buy on your store. So this is where you can really add value in the cycle. So the golden rule for me is basically give them all the information they need when they're looking to buy, and so they don't go elsewhere. And so just to show you some examples in the real world, kind of in the offline world, if you look at this picture here, this is from Cosmopolitan magazine. So, you know, for all the female attendees here, I'm sure you know how to make your eyes pretty, like on the left page here. There's brown eyes, green eyes, blue eyes. And if you look on the left page, there's a product here, you know, by Maybelline, that's basically an advertisement for this content marketing. And for the guys, if you go to Home Depot, you know, you're really into DIY stuff. You have a bunch of different guides here. You know, how to install your water heater, which cooler is right for you. I bet once you click on these articles, you know, you have the article, 10 tips for buying a grill. And on the bottom, it's like, hey, here's how you can buy it on Home Depot. Just click here and we'll ship it to your house. So this is another example of content marketing. And one more kind of food related. If you guys go to Whole Foods a lot, kind of the supermarket that sells a lot of organic food, they have big recipes here. I'm sure all of the recipes and all the content here you can find in their store wherever you go. So another form of content marketing that works well. And finally, the last one is in Fidelity. So Fidelity is a financial services firm where they sell mutual funds, bonds, stuff like that. So this article is just a blog post where they said, hey, you know, where the opportunities are in municipal bonds. And without going into much detail, if you go on the bottom right corner here, you see what Fidelity offers, you know, sell select bonds and CDs, why bonds at Fidelity, and you can basically start an account right there. So content marketing does work. If you think about it, you know, when you buy stuff, all the stuff you research on, if there was a site that you could go to with everything you needed, you know, it's more likely that you would buy there because you would trust that person, you would engage with them, and kind of they would be the authority on to where you're going to buy your product from. And of course, why we're all here, we don't have an idea, right? So that's kind of why we're here. And so here are some very quick tips that just to get you started. So the first thing to get an idea is you want to understand what people pay for, because if you have an idea where nobody is buying from you, it's there's no point, right? We're all here to kind of have an online store to make money so we can, you know, be millionaires like Andrew, right? All right. So here are three categories of things that people generally pay for. Okay. One is passion. So if you look at the crazy cat ladies that buy these insane toys for their cats, you know, they go out on all the organic foods for the cats, all these little toys. Clothing, you know, people pay for passions. And if you go to the musician, if you look at the kind of guys that love golf, they'll spend, you know, thousands of dollars just to reduce their swing by like one. And also travel and books. So the next one is problems. This is probably the biggest one. People pay for problems. Businesses pay for problems. You know, people pay for weight loss. I mean, I have mosquitoes living here in Asia, so I'll buy a net to kind of cover my bed when I sleep at night. And also, you know, if we could all fly, we wouldn't pay for airplane tickets, right? I mean, this is something we all pay for. So the last one is fears. You know, if you look at this week, there's the Mayan end of the world, and you see these articles where people are buying hordes and hordes of supplies of food and water and, you know, these evacuation shelters. So, you know, this is what people pay for. And, you know, when you get sick, you don't want to shell out thousands of dollars just to see the doctor, so you pay for health insurance. And also, when you're riding a motorcycle helmet, you don't want your head to crack open, so you'll obviously buy the helmet. So, you know, when you keep these three things in mind, what I would do is if you just make a list after this webinar, just to get an idea, you know, you write seven passions, seven problems, seven fears, and then you'll have 21 general ideas that you can branch off into just to get you started. And so one way to find ideas, you can go on Amazon. And so what a lot of the big best-selling products have on Amazon is customer reviews, right? And so when you go into the negative reviews, you can look for common themes within these reviews just to find stuff that you can add value on. So for example, in this cat litter box example I found, there seems to be trouble operating the litter box, like turning it so the litter scoops itself. And so this could be some, like an idea for a blog post if you sell cat litter box on how to add value, and maybe like a tip to really use this box more effectively. So another way is to use eBay. So eBay is a place where you have a lot of really weird stuff that comes from the internet overseas that shows up in the US. Like if you look at this cat toilet training kit, like I don't even know where this comes from, right? And because the thing is, a lot of the people, they import stuff overseas and they really think, well, where's the biggest marketplace? I'll just put it on eBay and see who buys it. So this is where you can get some really random ideas just to get started too. And so the next one I kind of like is Twitter. So Twitter is interesting because a lot of people say it's useless. People just tweet about the breakfast. They just say, you know, I'm eating a waffle for breakfast. But the power of this is it's actually plugged into everyone's mind real time. So you think about 10, 15 years ago, marketing agencies used to do expensive, huge surveys just to get just to do customer research. And now Twitter, you can really do it just by punching in a few keywords into the advanced search area. And what's interesting is there's also a positive, negative, and question type of tweet. Now, it's not completely accurate, but if you just put in your keyword in, you can say, you know, wine glasses, you know, negative, and then you can maybe get some ideas based off the feedback of people. And it's actually real time, which is very interesting. And so if you do this like every week or so, you'll see feedback. You can get real time feedback from products out there in the market, which marketers paid for, spent a lot of money on probably like a decade ago. So now I'm going to hand it over to Andrew for some tips, since he's obviously a bigger expert than me. So Andrew, I'll just run these on the screen and let me know when to move to the next one.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Terry. Appreciate it. We can go to the, let's start with that first one there. Let's talk about quickly about pricing. And so, excuse me, as you're thinking about what niche to get into, there's some criteria, in addition to the ones that Terry mentioned that I'd like to go over, that you wouldn't think might make a big difference, but they actually do. So quick pop quiz, you know, if you were going to make $10,000 a month, would you rather do it with 1,000 orders at $10 each or 100 orders at $100 each? And, you know, the second one is going to be so much easier because every time you do have a transaction, you're going to have the cost of, you know, the transaction fee with the credit card companies. You're going to have, but even more so than that, you're going to have the interaction of people having problems, people coming back and having returns, customer service issues. And so, you know, the fewer people, to a degree, the fewer people that you can help out, that you can sell those products to, and you can keep those transaction numbers lower, the easier it's going to be. But at the same time, you also don't want to necessarily go too high if you're selling products that are, you know, really high end and you only make a couple sales, say per month. That can work in some markets, but it's really tough to generate a lot of brand advocates. It's hard to get a lot of reviews for your products. It's hard to build a lot of fans, and so there's kind of a sweet spot, which we'll stop and talk about later. Some of the other issues you're going to want to consider when you're picking a niche is scalability. You know, is this something you can actually scale up without having to invest a lot into either processes or manpower? So, you know, and again, that price point, you know, if you're selling something that's $10,000, it's going to be difficult to scale, you know, without having to hire a bunch of people, because you're probably going to have a pretty high-touch sales cycle for that. Shipping costs, you know, one of my businesses is trolling motors, and one of the big downsides of that is, man, those things are expensive to ship. You know, and so in a day and age where most people expect free shipping or pretty inexpensive shipping, that's something you want to keep in mind. Customer support, how difficult is something to provide support for? And this is kind of a double-edged sword, because on one end, you don't want something that's insanely difficult to support with you know, for example, like nutritional supplements. I'm not a big fan of nutritional supplements. I think people have done well with them, but for me, you know, I don't want to sell anything that people can ingest in bodies and then they have all sorts of problems that, you know, may or may not have been caused by a product I'm selling, but they blame to me. That sounds like a support nightmare. and a liability nightmare. But if you do have an issue that's a little more difficult to set up, let's say maybe closed circuit, you know, TV cameras, if you're going to go buy one of those, if I was going to buy one, I would have no idea what to get. There's a bunch of different components and parts and accessories, and so you do want some level of complexity because that allows you to add value, like Terry was saying. You can put together buyer's guides. You can put together resources that show that you're the expert, and that's going to help make it more likely people are going to look to you as the expert and buy from you. Margins, drop shipping, if we haven't really talked about drop shipping with e-commerce, but it's a model where you don't have to buy products up front, you just buy them from a warehouse and ship them directly to your customer. Great way to get started, but the margins are a little bit smaller. And so if you're going to be starting selling your own products or selling with dropship products, you just need to be real cognizant of the margins because it's hard to make money with really small margin businesses, like with electronics and things like that. One way you can boost those margins is by selling accessory-rich markets or product lines. So, for example, a lot of times the higher-end products, say an electronic let's use a TV, a $500 TV might only have a 5 or 6% margin. The retailer might only be making, say, $25 off of it. But that HDMI cable that they sell, man, they're probably, marking that up from $5 to $30. And so that's where they make the money. So if you can find a niche where there's a lot of accessories that you can sell, that's where you'll probably make a lot of your money because the margins are much better on those. Marketing budgets, you want to think about how expensive it's going to be to get in front of the audience you're going to be targeting. So, and part of that, you can look at the competition, you can look at how strong some of the embedded, websites on the front page of Google are. Make sure you keep that in mind. Is it realistic that you can actually get in front of and rank well for the market you're going to be going after, or is it realistic you can actually buy advertising for them too? Same thing with the size of the market. Niche is kind of tough because you want to be able to pick a niche where there's enough people in it that you can build a viable business, but you don't want to pick something that's so niche that you're, if you capture 80% of the market, you're only going to do, $15,000 a year in sales. So there's kind of a fine line between, between getting too niche and going too broad.
Yeah, and just to add something here, realizing your niche is too small is something you don't realize until you jump into it. So I've talked to two businesses where basically they're the number one player. They were only making 300,000 to 400,000 a year. This is like the cap of the market. One was selling condoms in Australia, and he said the market was basically $35 million, and that was as big as it gets. And so he's really struggling to kind of reposition his business. So market size is something important, but it's not 100%. These factors aren't really, you can't guarantee them 100% before you start. So.
Right, exactly. Good point, Terry.
Yeah.
Local availability is something as well. If somebody can go down to local Walmart and buy what you're selling, that's tough. If you can find something that's kind of that is difficult to find locally, maybe not impossible, but difficult, you're gonna have a much better chance of selling things online because that's gonna be the number one place people come is online because they're like, well, I can't get it locally. Obviously, I'm gonna go online and get it. And so that helps if you can find something like that. And then product market fit. Terry, do you have any? I didn't put that one on there.
This is something I added yesterday, but basically, you want to look at a market and make sure there's a product that makes it that fits for it, because you don't want to make something like dog collars with diamonds on it and no one buys it. You don't want to do something crazy like that. So you always want to be conscious of of the feedback loop you have with your customers and potential buyers. So you actually really, you can laser down what you're selling into something that they'll actually want and buy, and not just random idea.
That's a good point. Really good quote I've heard as well is when you're getting started selling something new, you should do one of two things. You should sell an existing product to a new audience, or you should sell a new product to an existing audience. But if you try to create a new product and sell it to a new audience, you're probably really going to struggle because you need to have one of those two things in place beforehand. And so if you've got a great idea for manufacturing something, it might work out well, but before you go and spend $50,000 to have it built and source overseas and create a website, make a bunch of prototypes locally and go to an organization, your target customers, and see if they'll buy it. And if you don't see a whole lot of interest, don't move forward with it. So So that's one of the reasons why reselling stuff, you're not going to make probably as much in margin if you resell things or drop ship items, but it is going to be a little bit safer because you can do some research and you can see people actually are actively searching for these items. And so I know that there's the demand there. It's just a matter now of getting in front of those people, providing the right value and marketing that well.
Yeah, so. And so this brings us to our next kind of golden rule here is the pricing. So you want to keep items within $100, $200. So, Andrew, you want to go?
Beautiful mugshots there, Terry.
Yeah, so why should we do it between $100 to $200? So what's your thoughts, man?
This is more of an overall order size as opposed to an overall product size because, again, some products and accessories are going to be much less than $200 and are going to be great. But the reason kind of that ballpark range why I like that a lot is it's a good range. That $200 product or $200 order is enough where, if you've got a 20 or let's say you've got a 30% margin, you're going to be able to make $50-$60 on that order, which is pretty decent. But if it's not so big that you're necessarily going to have people call up and have a whole lot of hand-holding from a customer service and a sales perspective in order to close that sale. So it's kind of perfect, at least what I think is a great balance between scalability without having to scale your customer service and profitability.
Yeah, okay. And so next we're just going to jump into some general tips and then we'll wrap it up with some Q&A. So this next one is, when you're looking for an idea, you want to see if the market's growing, right? So, you don't want to get into the, print magazine industry. That's kind of a bad industry to be in right now. So, when you're looking for an idea, make sure this is something, that's growing in the near to long term, 3 to 5 years, that you can really get into and dig your feet into. And so also the other thing to consider is the competition really forward thinking, right? I mean, can you beat them on an SEO front, on a marketing front? Can you really add more value? So Andrew, do you have anything to add to this?
Yeah, I'd say, using Google Trends and Google Insights is a great way to look at, the trends of a market. I would say, while ideally you do want something that's growing, I'd also say don't completely write everything off that is maybe not growing rapidly or maybe even has a little bit of minor decline. So that's a little bit trickier of a decision and it requires a little more discernment when you're picking a niche if you're looking into a declining, outdated market. But sometimes some of the best markets are legacy markets that were around, way back in the day and people just don't think they exist anymore or, the people who originally got into the business are kind of old school and maybe when the internet, when the internet got kicking and really commerce has moved online, they really didn't catch up with that. And so sometimes there are opportunities in those older markets or slowing markets where it's a good market because of the size of the market, even though it is gradually declining, and because the competition just isn't that sophisticated.
So. Yeah. All right, cool. And so next one is also demand. So this ties into the growing market concept, right? If your market's growing and there's also demand, that's a good sign, good place to be in, right? Because you want to be in a place where it's declining and your product could get, substituted in the next 5 years. Maybe it's on the decline. So that's something to keep in mind. And also, which ties into, can you be the market leader in 2 to 3 years, right? Because, if you're getting into e-commerce, it's really not a get rich quick, I'm going to make $1 million in, like 5 months. Because, Andrew's, how long have you been in business, Andrew?
I've been doing it for 5 years.
Yeah. And how long did it take to actually really take off to where you were comfortable with?
I'd say it probably took a year of full-time work for me to get to a point where I could, support a family full-time comfortably. It took about a year of work. It definitely isn't something that you can do overnight. It's something that you kind of got to stick with for the long run, like most things worth doing.
Yeah, exactly. But in the end, remember, can you add value to the customer? Because this is what really makes people buy from you and they buy from you again, the lifetime value of a customer, all that good stuff. So other ways you can come up with ideas, you can look at what's working already. How can you make it better? Look for a bestseller and look at the negative reviews and kind of come up with a new idea. You can sell something maybe in a different color, like the white iPhone. It's obviously the same phone, but it comes in a different color and people still buy it. So maybe something bigger, something smaller. There was a business I saw that sold yoga mats. And basically, the regular yoga mat's quite small if you're like a pretty big guy and you do yoga. But this guy basically sold it in a huge square. It was like a 4x4 yoga square. And so, you can come up with something bigger, maybe smaller. And also a different market, like Andrew said, take something old into a new market. to, you know, kind of just disrupt people that way. And so you can also do different channels. Maybe you can go direct, cut out the distributors, make something cheaper or luxurious. You know, the cars have a great market for this. You know, you have the Mercedes on the top end, and you have, I guess, your Hyundai's or other manufacturers on the low end. And so also bundling. So this is something from Andrew. Can you talk about this one a little bit?
Sure. This is probably one of my favorite ways to add value to, for example, a product that you're reselling that you're not making, and maybe a lot of other people on the market sell it too. So how can you stand out and add value? Well, if you go back to the closed, you know, kind of the security camera example, if I show up in any security camera on a site, and I have to go through and try to manually piece stuff together, and I'm worried if is this what I need? Are all these cables going to work together? Does it hook up to my DVR right? How does this all work? One thing that has a huge amount of value to me is if I come in across a bunch of packages where they say, hey, do you need a 2 to 3, you have a small home and just need a couple cameras? Here's a complete package. All the components work together. We guarantee it. It comes with an installation guide. You don't have to worry about spending, 5 hours researching this stuff. Here you go, bam. That adds a tremendous amount of value to me as a shopper and a consumer. And it's something you can do as an e-commerce merchant to add a lot of value without having to add, without having to add a lot of expense. So bundling products, kind of, using your expertise to pre-shop for people and create custom packages is something that is a great way to inexpensively add value to customers.
Okay, and this is one more slide I have in this slideshow. So this is the magical zone of money, which is also I found from a book by Alan Weiss. So basically, when you're starting your online store, there's a lot of people that say online, you need to follow your passions, do what you like. But there's also the two other aspects, right, which is market need and competency. So if you have something and you have a market need, but you have passion, but you don't know how to get your site ranked up, you don't know how to do the e-commerce, really the in the ground stuff, you'll lose to the competition. If you have passion, competency, but no market need, you have something that nobody will buy. And if you have competency and a market need, but no passion, you have something you hate, you're really working in your business instead of on your business, which is kind of like, or maybe you have a job too. So the magical zone obviously is to be in the middle where kind of all three intersect. And this is kind of a useful tool that I found when you guys are planning your online stores in the future. And so also Andrew has a free ebook on his website, Profitable E-Commerce. He goes into more details about finding suppliers and analyzing, doing the SEO front and really looking at competitors and how to talk to suppliers and just take what we've done today and take it a step further. So with that being said, that is the last slide. And so if any have any questions, you guys can go ahead and type it in the chat right now. And I'll just go ahead and kick off with the first one. So a lot of people get stuck on platform, Andrew. So what's kind of like, real quick, which platform would you suggest we get started on if we want to get an online store?
In terms of a shopping cart?
Yeah.
I'd say, it's funny, I actually just chatted with a cart expert a couple weeks ago and asked him this exact same question. And I'd probably, if you're just getting started, I'd recommend either Shopify or BigCommerce. If aesthetics is really important and maybe you're in the fashion industry or you're in the apparel industry, or you just need a real basic cart up quickly, Shopify is probably the better bet. They've got great themes and templates, very easy to get up and running quickly, and the stores just look beautiful out of the box. If you kind of are doing something a little bit more of a full-fledged, larger e-commerce store, functionality is really important to you, and design isn't as critical, or you're going to be, you've got some design chops, or maybe you've got someone who can help you create a little bit more of an eye-catching design, then BigCommerce is probably the best bet. They're going to be, they're more of a full-featured platform. They've got more of the features built in the initial package and the initial kind of cart that you get, and it's a little more robust of a platform.
Okay, all right. And so what are your thoughts on dropshipping versus actually making your own product? Because I know margins in dropshipping are a lot lower.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, if you're drop shipping something, it's you've got the manufacturer's got to get a cut, right? The wholesaler has to get a cut, and then to you, some of that margin is going to be gone. And then also the other thing is there's going to be more. It's a product that already exists on the market, and so there's going to be a lot more competition, which will drive prices down. And so drop ship products are going to have smaller margins. That being said, manufacturing your own product is, it's involved. I know it's getting easier, and in the world we live in today, it's getting easier to do overseas and more quickly. But I'm saying, if you're getting started, I would recommend going the drop shipping route, because you know there's a product that exists, you know that there's demand for it if you do your research properly, and being able to get an online store up, identify with your customers, understand what their pain points are, create the right resources, connect with them, and market your store effectively. It's a lot of work. If you add the uncertainty of, you know, of creating a product, manufacturing it, wondering if it's going to work, into that those other things as well, you know, that's a lot of variables and a lot of stuff that can go wrong. So starting out, I really think, you know, drop shipping, or you don't even have to drop ship, but selling an existing product, you could order it bulk to save a little bit on margins, you know, and ship it yourself. But I think selling an existing product line is the way to go for most e-commerce merchants that are just getting started. So it's going to reduce the risk. It's going to let you focus on what's really important. And then once you get, some experience and you understand kind of how the basics work a little bit more, and you've got some, track record of success, then you can say, okay, well, hey, now we can talk about manufacturing our own product. Or, you know, now we can maybe look at, we know this customer in this niche really well. What products do they need that aren't offered? Well, let's go manufacture one of those.
Yeah, all right. And now you have two questions, one from Michelle, one from Daniel. Daniel, I'll get to yours in a bit. So Michelle asks, how do you guys suggest gauging when there's too much competition for a product? For example, in pet accessories, you know, with a big market like that, how do you even know when something is too big?
That's a great question. You know, there's a couple different things I would look at. I would look at, one, the strength of the competition for that term in Google. So, you know, let's say did she give a product example in there, Terry?
No, she says pet accessories, but I'll let you go first before I give my thoughts, though.
Okay, so let's say pet accessories. That's a pretty broad niche, but if you went in and you went into Google and typed in pet accessories and you looked at the top 10 results, there's a bunch of different metrics that you can look at to see how strong and how entrenched they are. How many links, how many different domains are linking to their sites is one example. Another metric would be, how sophisticated are other sites? Are they pretty nice value-adding sites where if you landed there, you'd be real comfortable buying some accessories there? Or are they kind of tattered, thrown together hack eBay shops that, you know, you'd never enter your credit card in a million years? And so there's a bunch of different ways you can analyze that from an SEO standpoint and from a usability standpoint. And I talk about a lot of those metrics in the ebook in more detail. But really, it's the strength from an SEO and a usability standpoint. That would be how I would measure primarily the strength of the competition.
Yeah, that's kind of what I agree too, because really, in the end, your online store is still going to come from online traffic, unless you had such a big following that's coming from either through Facebook or through social media. But I think those businesses are really hard to set up now, especially in, you know, the pet accessory, where it's kind of commoditized, unless you can really come through with a breakthrough idea where it spreads on its own and it has like a viral coefficient where it kind of grows on its own. So that's one of my thoughts too. Basically, if you look at the SEO, the top 10, they're really hard to beat. Maybe that's something you shouldn't look into. So
exactly.
Yeah. All right. And so next one, Michelle, hope that's answered your questions. If it doesn't, just shoot me an email. I've seen you active on the Facebook page. Just let us know there. So I'm going to go on to Daniel's question. What is the best option for credit card processing? Should we use PayPal versus a custom credit card merchant for a startup? So, Andrew?
Yeah, another great question. I would say definitely have PayPal be an option when people are checking out. I did a relaunch of my CB store probably about, I guess, coming up on a year ago now. And before, I didn't offer PayPal. And with the relaunch, we started offering PayPal. And I was amazed. I think like 30 to 35%, almost a third of people paid with PayPal, which just blew me away. And so you definitely want to have it as a payment option on your website. I would not recommend, though, having it be the only payment option on your website, or having them be your merchant processor. PayPal, they're universal, they're great. They also kind of get a bad reputation sometimes for being real protectionistic and giving merchants a hard time about sometimes, you know, putting their funds in reserve or locking up their funds. And, that's probably not something most people are going to experience, but from an e-commerce perspective, I prefer to go through a kind of a more of a standard straight-up processing merchant. And there's two that I'd recommend. Let me step back. When you process credit cards through a merchant, you have to have two providers, one called the Merchant Gateway and one called the Payment Gateway, and then the Merchant kind of service provider. And they do different roles, and there's kind of some different aspects to each of them that I won't get into now, but you'll need both. And the two that I would recommend that I use, one is Authorize.net, and they're kind of they're a real well-known player in the space. They're kind of the payment gateway. They kind of handle the moving the credit card information securely from your site to a kind of a safe third party. And then from a processor standpoint, a company called Gravity Payments, Gravity like you know, you drop a ball and it falls, Gravity Payments out of Seattle. They're fantastic. So that being said, if you're on a cart like Shopify or BigCommerce, you won't need to use those because those guys are hosted, and I believe most of those will have kind of the payment integration built into that. And so you won't have to worry about that. This is only if you're going to be running your own cart on your own servers with something like, say, Magento or OpenCart or PrestaShop, something like that.
Yeah, and one thing with PayPal I just want to add is that if you just go Google, you know, PayPal sucks, like in Google, you'll see all these stories where, because the thing is with PayPal, what I've heard is that the algorithm for setting off their kind of spam or, you know, this guy's flag thing is very draconian. So once it's flagged, I've heard the customer service people can't actually manually turn it off. It's actually a very lengthy process that goes through their entire company. And, you know, PayPal's
it can be a nightmare sometimes. I haven't had too many problems with them. I've had a few, but like you said, Terry, they have a bit of a reputation.
Yeah, and it's usually this happens from when I've talked to like people in the internet marketing world. They suddenly, you know, they launch a new product and they suddenly make like, you know, 10K a day when their previous activity was really low, and then they get flagged and then their money gets hold, gets shut down, and then they get screwed. So, I mean, this really goes into kind of like the supplier thing you talked about, Andrew. Never go with one supplier. Always have a backup, whether you're sourcing your products or even your credit card processor.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And so those are the two questions. I don't see any more questions. So with that, you know, I'll leave it out for another minute or so. No questions.